Thank you for downloading the Sparkwood and 21 podcast. We are discussing the television series Twin Peaks. This podcast is brought to you by No Ship Network. I am your host, Em.
And I'm your host, Steve. Spoiler warning, we are not a spoiler-free podcast. We spoil. So we would love to have you listen, but please, if you haven't seen the whole series, stop what you're doing, watch it, and then listen to us. You have been warned.
If you would like to support this podcast, the best way to do it is to head over to iTunes and write us a review. You don't have to write a review. You can just click on some stars, and that would be nice, too.
Don't be shy.
And you can also support us by going to our website at noship.net. We have a contact page that you can look at, and it will direct you to the various means you can reach us, such as our Twitter, our Facebook, and our Gmail account. And our Gmail account is a great way to write us letters that you want to have read on our podcast.
We also have an Amazon link. Just go to noship.net, click on the Amazon link, and it takes you to the Amazon homepage. From there, you can do your shopping as usual, and it doesn't cost you anything extra, but we get a little bit of a kickback for pie and coffee and guns. Well, because they were in this episode.
Okay. All right. So before we get into recap, do you have a PSA?
For the remainder of the podcast, for your safety and ours, please stay on the bike.
So any thoughts on this episode?
Not too bad of an episode. It has about 95% more Josie Packard than I'd like to have in my average Twin Peaks episode, but I'm making allowances for it because she's gone after this one. So that's all I really have to say before we get into the recap. How about you?
I like this episode mostly. And there's some parts I didn't like, but yeah.
Mm-hmm. There's good Albert in it.
Yeah, it is good Albert. You're right.
Because Albert was in, it was either last episode or the one before that, I forget.
Is it because he calls Josie a bitch?
Exactly. Because we had some listeners kind of say that they missed the snarkiness of the old Albert, but it's pretty much in full form here, yeah. So they should be happy with it.
All right, so let's get into recap, unless you had anything else to say?
No.
Okay. We are discussing Twin Peaks, The Condemned Woman. It's written by Tricia Brock and directed by Leslie Linkeglatter. The episode opens with a close-up of an ornamental owl and a chessboard. The camera pans slowly past the chess pieces and passes over Caroline's death mask. Wyndham Earle's voice is heard taunting Cooper and speculating why he has not yet made a move. Cooper is sharing this new recording from Wyndham Earle with Truman. Truman says he is not going to let Cooper out of his sight. Cooper says if Wyndham Earle wanted him dead, he would be dead already. Then Truman has Lucy call the paper and Pete. That's in alphabetical order. And Cooper tells Truman that Caroline was the love of his life.
I think we hear Lucy in two scenes in this episode, but we don't ever see her.
Mm-mm. Out of sight, but not out of mind.
Alphabetical. I got a good laugh out of that.
Yeah, you did.
There's not a whole lot of laughs in this episode, but that was good. I like that. I think there's one other really funny thing in here. But
it's probably Albert.
Yeah. That was more like, well, there's a couple of snaps in this episode.
Yeah. Yeah.
They're really good. There's some people tipping 20%. And not just Wyndham Earle with his little creepy messages.
Okay, so Pete gets the call from Sheriff's Department. So we're now at the Packard residence, and Pete gets the call from the Sheriff's Department requesting his services. We see that he's serving breakfast to Catherine and Andrew Packard. Pete has made faces out of the breakfast foods for Andrew. Catherine is not amused, though Andrew is. Pete leaves. Catherine asks Andrew about the Ghostwood Estates, and then Josie walks in the door and sees Andrew for the first time. She passes out. It's amusing to Catherine and Andrew equally.
It's amusing to the viewer, too, because that's just not really a believable pass out at all.
She
slides to the floor, and then her head just kind of rests gently in the crook of her arm. That's not how that works. You're knocking your head on something if you really just pass out from a standing position. It's inevitable. Your head is going to hit something hard. Not that that happens to me with any kind of frequency or anything. I'm just saying, you know, it's just an observation of reality.
So now we're back at the sheriff's department. Harry's charging Hank with attempted murder of Leo.
Mm-hmm.
Hank offers a trade for the info on who killed Andrew Packard. Truman says no deal, but Hank can't resist playing his hand just to hurt Harry. He alludes to Josie's involvement in Andrew Packard's murder. Hawk trips up Hank for this insolence. Truman yells, "Get him out of here!"
Very dramatically. Very... Yes. Chris Mulkey actually does some really good acting in this episode, I think, and it's his swan song because we don't see him again after this because he's pretty much up the creek without a paddle.
I read a I don't know if it was in the oral histories, but he said that the anger we see, and I think it's when he's with Norma, is like he was really angry because he was very upset that he was written off the show. Like that was his real anger we were seeing.
That's pretty cool that he's channeling it into the character. The best part about this scene is Hawk, who's just like, "Oh, sorry," when he trips him because he's already in crutches from getting his ass beat by Nadine. But I think the most surprising thing about this scene is that Hank Jennings actually knew the definition of the word constituents. I was shocked.
All right, so Albert reports to Cooper that the bullets found in Mr. Lee's body and Cooper's bullet wounds match. Josie shot Cooper. Albert was ready to go cuff her, but Cooper pleads restraint. He wants to try to talk her into a confession.
It seems like he's been stringing this along because Albert's kind of given him enough evidence to put her away with this a couple episodes back, or at the very least last episode, and he just keeps playing that line of Albert, not a word until we know for sure. You know for sure. You've already known for sure. It's just overkill on the cautious side of things, and it's kind of annoying, actually. And I understand how much he cares for Harry and everything, but if he's really wants to be a good friend, he needs to pull him aside and be like, look, your girl did this. She shot me. She shot the Asian man. You need to do something about this and be the sheriff. But instead, he's just like he's waiting for some sort of thunderbolt to come down and make everything all right. So.
No, I think he's trying to he's doing it for Harry. That's why he's that's what he, I mean, he expressly says that. I think he's trying to give Josie the chance to come in with dignity, and that will be better for Harry rather than them having to actually cuff her and bring her in. Like, think about it, if it was me, what would be better for you if I turn myself in gracefully or with some dignity? I don't know if you can really turn yourself gracefully, but or if I was dragged in cuffs.
I want to see you get tackled like those catch a predator guys, like when they're trying to run to their cars. No, I get your point. He's trying to be a good friend and let the situation play itself out with minimal involvement on his part. But I still feel like he's kind of being remiss as a lawman by not doing something about this when he has all of the evidence in front of him. It's one thing to let somebody do the right thing, to kind of give them the space and the opportunity to do the right thing. It's another thing to just go, I know they did it. I have enough evidence, but I'm gonna stand back and let not only an attempted murderer, but a murderer walk around free when I know that they did it and I have the evidence to
You're
do
right, because
something.
Albert makes that point later. He says she's ventilating everybody, so, or
Yeah,
I
I
don't know
mean,
if he.
it's just a matter of time till she does it again. She has a horrible track record, so. It becomes almost criminally irresponsible to let this person walk the streets after a while.
You're right.
So that's all I'm trying to say. But I understand his motives, and he has a big heart for doing that. But I just think it's bad police work.
It's not very good professionalism.
Yeah.
All right, so now Audrey is preparing to do her time as a concierge. She is met with some brusqueness from a fellow coworker.
I kind of see his point, though.
Yeah, I see his point.
He's being a jerk about it. I mean, he could be cool and just work with her about it, but I mean, and it's probably no secret if you work at the Great Northern that, Ben Horn's daughter is going to be taking it over whenever he retires. So it kind of is a little bit stupid on his part to do that because you're stepping on the toes of your future boss. It's kind of
I don't,
hard.
yeah, but I don't think she'll be petty about it.
Hopefully not. I don't think she will either. It doesn't seem to be in her character because she probably already forgot about it once it
Yeah,
was
once he
done.
walked away.
She's actually like rolling up her sleeves. I have respect for her because she's actually trying to learn the business from the ground up.
She's not just skating through there.
Yeah.
So she sits down at the desk, flustered after that guy walks away, and Billy Zane arrives and needs a additional transport because his van was too full with his own personal property from his own private jet. Audrey is taken with him at this point when she hears the private. Well, she's taken with him when she sees him,
Right.
and then the private jet also helps. And until he says that he has a picture of her in pigtails, and she seems to cool a little bit towards him, he talks a little bit further about it and talks about how she was dressed up as Heidi, and then she has this fond memory, and she, when she recalls the event and begins to talk about it, he has walked away.
I think maybe the catch a predator people need to tackle him. I mean, that's kind of creepy. Like, there's this picture of you when
When
you're a
you're
little,
10.
you're 10 years old, and you just look so good. All right, to be fair, he just said something about her being incredibly cute, which is
Yeah.
innocuous or whatever. But the whole time he's talking, There's a Derek Zoolander's voice in my head just going, "Put a cork in it, Zane."
It was Derek Zoolander. It wasn't the other guy, Hansel.
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 Well, yeah, because he was going to have the walk off with Hansel, and everybody was, you know, Billy Zane was kind of trying to counseling him not to do it, and that's when he was like, "Put a cork in it, Zane," and then Hansel.
I can see him doing it now.
And then Hansel goes, "You should listen to your friend Billy Zane." Anyway, I think I'm not cracking on Billy Zane, honestly. I think he does a good job. He's a great actor, and I think he does a good job as this character. But I can't see him and not think of that line.
Okay, so Audrey gets back to work and opens a letter that has been torn and containing an invitation to the Roadhouse. Save the one you love.
An invitation to love.
So now at Ed's place, Nadine comes home early from school to confess to Ed that she and Mike are in love. She is worried that Ed may be hurt, but then she says they are breaking up.
And she also tells him that they had a magical night, and he's like, "All night?"
She's like, "Well, you and Norma did it."
So I felt like this scene was a little bit off, because if he's so into Norma now, I mean, shouldn't he just be like going like just high five in the sky?
I think he is when he's hugging her.
Yeah.
In his mind.
In his mind, like, yeah.
Whoa.
This is awesome.
Yes.
I don't have to do it. She's doing it for me.
So now back at the Packards, Cooper questions Josie about what happened in Seattle. Catherine spies. Josie is still not admitting to her involvement in Mr. Lee's murder. Cooper tells her he is doing this for Harry. He tells her she has no more options.
Which is to say, Josie, the shenanigans are over.
They are not over, as we shall see.
Yeah.
Cooper leaves. Catherine barges in with false cheerfulness. Josie is in midst of panic, so this is foreshadowing her heart attack she has, or whatever you want to call it, when her heart gives out at the end. Catherine continues to tighten the screws on Josie regarding Andrew and Mr. Eckhart. Josie asks Catherine for help. Catherine tells her to tell Mr. Eckhart the truth. Catherine suggestively hunts for keys on a bookshelf, which uncover a gun, which she allows for Josie to see. Josie walks over and takes the gun, grateful for this option. So why do you think Catherine did that? Why did she not say it out loud? Hey, here's a gun.
Yeah, it's a good question, because she's basically doing all of this exposition out loud to let the audience know what's going on. So maybe, you had brought up earlier, we were talking about it, and you thought maybe that she wanted to make sure that nobody was eavesdropping, because that seems to be a thing in this house, because she's eavesdropped on people from like an intercom system.
Exactly.
You know, earlier in the series. So maybe that's what's going on there. And she doesn't want anybody to be listening to her, whether it's Pete or whether it's her brother or whatever else. But I think her brother would be in on it.
Yeah, you would think. But
so I guess it would just really be Pete that she doesn't want, you know, because she knows how defensive he gets about Josie and stuff like that. And, you know, I've always criticized her acting, you know, this whole time and everything. But
Josie's
acting. Sorry, not Catherine's. But she really plays somebody on the edge of panic very well. That feeling that you're about to just like start shaking uncontrollably, and the way she kind of hugs herself, and it lends an aura of reality to it. So I actually thought she did a good job in that scene.
So now Bobby and Ben meet in Ben's office. Ben is in his jogging suit and he's eating celery. So Ben invites Bobby to sit in on this business meeting, board meeting. Audrey's there. Billy Zane, okay, who is John Justice Wheeler, but prefers to be called Jack, because men who have money named John like to be called Jack. It seems.
Is that a truism, or is this just something you were observing?
I'm just thinking of John Kennedy and
and
this guy. Those are the only ones I know of.
She called him when he was mentioning when she was doing the concierge stuff. She called him Rockefeller, didn't she?
Yes.
Like derisively. Yeah. Okay. That's not actually one of his names, though. It's just.
It's not his name.
John Jack Jacob Jingleheimer Schmidt. Okay,
go
ahead.
So Ben introduces Jack as someone who came up the hard way. Audrey says, "Oh, how nice." Jack and Audrey steal. Oh, so now everybody's seated. Ben begins talking to everybody. Ben sits before Jerry, Jack, Audrey, and Bobby. Ben is building up his plan to save the Pine Weasel. Meanwhile, Audrey and Jack are stealing glances from one another. After Ben concludes with his Pine Weasel plan, Audrey says, "Then what?" And he says he is considering a run for the Senate, which is stupid with his
This guy
checkered
off his
past.
fucking rocker. I mean, come on.
One-Eyed Jacks, Laura Palmer. I mean, all this stuff's going to come up. Really?
That's just, those are just two of the bigger things that's happened. There's probably a myriad of other little things that would add up to a no way, you know? 'Cause, I mean, you have to, I forgot what it's called whenever you're deciding to do, you're deciding to run for political office, but you hire people to see if it's a feasible thing.
Yeah.
And there's a term for it, and it's escaping me right now. But I mean, they would come back in 10 minutes and be like, "Sorry, pal, it's not going to work." But this scene is interesting to me, not because of the pine weasel per se, but because of this version of Ben Horn that we get. So after his Civil War period is now gone and buried, thankfully, we have the Fila jumpsuit wearing stalk of celery wielding Ben Horn. Which is, I guess, is supposed to be a contrast to the suit and tie cigar wielding Ben Horn, who we actually see later on in this episode. So it's just funny though, because he's always has a cigar and he's always waving it around. Now he's got a stalk of celery, and this thing touched almost everything in the room.
Yeah.
And then right at the end of the scene, he just puts it in his mouth. And you know, I'm taken out of my suspension of disbelief because I'm sitting here thinking, going, was there a fill-in celery stalk, you know, did he have one that was kind of like his prop that he's touching everything with? And then when it's time for him to take a chomp out of it, they give him the fresh one and be like, "Here you go."
I mean,
They
he
look the
didn't,
same.
when he had his cigars, he didn't touch everything with that, did he?
No, he didn't. But he's almost using it's not just a substitute for the cigar. It's also like a pointer, like he's, you know, lecturing in class and it's, or he's conducting. I don't know, but he's very animated with it. I always remembered that about season 2 was the celery stalk. It's one of the things that stuck out in my head. I forgot a lot of other things, but that always stuck with me.
So now the double R. Windham Earl is posing as a truck driver, and he leaves an envelope addressed to Shelley Johnson. Norma is on the phone with Annie, her sister. Annie is leaving a convent. Shelley opens the envelope and discovers the same invitation Audrey received earlier. Ed comes into the diner and asks Norma to marry him. They kiss.
That's a pretty nice embrace, and you can't see Big Ed's hand, but it looks like it's on her butt. I'm just saying.
It's very theatrical.
Theatrical.
And Shelley was cute, the
Yeah,
way
she
she.
keeps like peeking back, you
Yeah.
know. She
So.
makes that little thing with her lips, like, "Ooh, I'm telling."
So, yeah, we're going to see Annie next episode, I think. And so that's our first introduction to her character. Anything about Shelley in the letter?
I just think it's crazy that any of them are going to go and do
I
this.
know, and Norma even cautioned her against it. And I think after Norma said her piece, Shelley was like, maybe it's from a friend. Like, did you just have a friend sit down in front of you?
Yeah, and you know, Windham Earl shows up at the Roadhouse in the same disguise that he used to go to the Double R Diner. Like, he didn't reveal himself to anybody else when he delivered the letters, because Audrey got hers from a day before, and I forgot how Donna got hers, but.
I don't think we ever saw how she got hers.
But she got one.
Yeah.
So maybe he just sent it to, you know, her house. I
Yeah.
don't know, or whatever. But it's like he shows up there in the same trucker disguise and sits there watching them. You know, like Shelley's not gonna go, "Hey, you were sitting right where I got this letter today." The 2 plus 2, but such is the world of Twin Peaks.
All right. So now we have a scene where Leo is whittling some twigs. Wyndham Earl tells him, "Good job, good boy." And Wyndham puts an arrowhead on the end of one of the shaved down twigs.
So he's basically making arrow shafts, and he doesn't even have Eric DeRay doesn't even have a speaking line in this, does he?
No.
He's just kind of sits there in his red flannel, you know, whittling away,
But
and
he looks
then
pretty excited about the arrow once he puts the Wyndham puts the arrowhead on it. He gets pretty animated looking there.
see, you know, I think about the character arc of him and like all the different ways he gets to play Leo Johnson, and he goes from being this like tough guy, trucker, wife beater type dude to almost reverting to an infantile state, to where
Yeah.
somebody is literally feeding him and wiping his ass, to now he's in this kind of like 10-year-old thing. I don't even know how to describe it. He's just kind of like looking up to Windham Earl because he's got this shock collar on him, and if he doesn't do what he says, he's gonna get shocked. It was a nice touch on the trucker uniform too, to have or the trucker disguise, to have the big gut. Which Windham Earl doesn't actually have.
You notice the gold tooth?
I did not notice a gold tooth.
Oh, too bad for you.
Damn it.
So Hank lies awake on his jailhouse bunk. Norma visits to ask for a divorce, When he gets up from his bunk and he walks towards her, he exaggerates his limp so he can elicit sympathy.
Yeah, he's hamming it up for sure.
She tells him that she has to get on with her life. He asks for one last favor. Hank wants Norma to tell the sheriff that he was at the restaurant the night Leo was shot. She tells him no. He gets angry and threatens her, and he tells her that she is Ed's whore. And she says she would rather be Ed's whore than Hank's wife. Ooh.
Damn. God damn, that's harsh. For any man to ever hear that is just, I mean, Hank has definitely done enough and more to deserve something like that. But still, just to hear that, that's a slam dunk snap.
Now, you want to talk about good acting, Norma,
Yeah.
Peggy Lipton, right there. I mean, the look on her face when she says that, it was like this mixture of emotions to me. It was like she's angry, but then wounded that she has to say these things at the same time. Impressive acting.
And you had mentioned before some of the research you had done had led you to believe that there was like a they never really got along on set anyway because he was a little bit too forward or
Hands-on.
hands on and had insisted on doing a scene a certain way at the beginning, like the first time that they see each other. So she was always kind of like off put by him, unless they became friends or something since then because it was quite a while ago, but. Maybe she's just pouring the dislike that she actually has for this person into the character,
Yeah.
And this jail scene seems to kind of play itself out a couple of times because you have, Catherine and Ben, and then you have these two, and then there was even Ben and Pete,
James and Donna.
James and Donna. Yeah. So it's kind of like a Twin Peaks standard. It's kind of like a go-to because you have the person who is getting talked to and told this is what's going on. This is how it's going to be. And the other person on the other side of the bars is untouchable, literally. And they can just kind of waltz out of there and be like, so long, sucker.
Yeah, it just reminded me of when Ben was in there because he was always wiping the bars, but now he's touching his celery stick on everything.
Yeah. Maybe he lost the whole germaphobe thing whenever he came through the other side of the Civil War. Now that the South has won, things aren't as dirty. I don't know.
She leaves him yelling her name.
And shaking the bars, which seemed to have a good amount of give to them.
Yeah, it was not very sturdy.
No.
So now we have a scene of Pete pontificating over a chessboard at the sheriff's department. There is a 5-minute time limit, Cooper says.
Yeah. Through a mouthful of donuts.
Pete manages to make a move that will protect Cooper's pieces for now, for at least like 5 moves or so, he's saying. He shouldn't lose any pieces for the next five. I mean, is that even possible? Like, you can actually predict that far out where.
I'll say this. If somebody is dead set on trading pieces with you and in the game, you can't avoid it because you can only move past so much. I mean, if they want to move their pawns up, just and that's all they're doing and just attack, 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 they can
Especially
do
this
that.
early on in the game because there's so many pieces on the
Exactly.
board.
The board's crowded at this
Yeah.
point. So it's very easy to take a piece if you're intent on doing so. The only thing that they can really bank on that would lend it a little bit of reality is the fact that Wyndham Earl has this sort of code that they mention, and he's not going to just go for the pawn grab. He's not just going to take a pawn just because, even though he did that with the Vagrant Powell, that he did just take a pawn for that move, but I think what Cooper's saying is that he's not going to do that just to do it. He's going to make the best move that's Or let me rephrase that. He's going to make the move that's best for his plan for the game. He's not just going to take a pawn because he can. So with what Pete's doing, if they're playing the game in all earnestness, he can make it difficult for he can kind of stymie his plans a little bit. But if he really wants to trade pieces, he can do it. It's chess after all. You can just foolishly attack and take pieces. That's not really a big deal. If Wyndham Earl wanted to really kill somebody, that wouldn't be that hard.
Albert arrives and he has more details concerning Cooper's shooting, and he reveals these to Cooper out of Harry's earshot. Albert is ready to bust this bitch.
Oh, another snap. Finally, Albert just brings it out, this bitch.
Harry walks by and looks at them and figures out the gist of their conversation and storms off.
He knows.
So we have a scene of Josie putting on lipstick.
So this recalls the very first scene we ever saw of Josie. It's pretty much like frame for frame, almost the exact same thing. I mean, I
Even when she turns around.
yeah. I mean, I didn't watch them side by side on a split screen or anything, but if you had showed me one and then showed me the other, I mean, I'd like to see if I could even pick out the differences, maybe the length of her hair. But I mean, even in the first episode, it was kind of slicked back, so you didn't really know that.
What do you think she was putting makeup on for?
I don't know. That's a good question. Maybe it's something that comforts her whenever she's going into a really bad situation where, you know, she's the chips are down. She kind of tries to accentuate her best weapon, which is her beauty.
Think you're right. Okay, so Andrew knocks on her door. He has brought some champagne. He has forgiven her. She says that Eckhart made her do it, and he tells her not to lie to him anymore. He wants her to go to Eckhart and talk to him.
I like this little scene because it showed you that, you know, when he gets in the scene with Josie, he does such a great job of acting, and it's really heartfelt. I really think Andrew has actually forgiven her, and but he's also wary of her at the same time. He's just like, look, don't even spin your wily witch's ways, you know, towards me. Don't say the, 'cause she's gonna play the oh Andrew thing with
Yeah.
him, and he's like, no, I'm not gonna have it. You know, I forgive you, but we're done with this chapter, and you're not gonna see me again. So I thought it was really well acted, and it gives you a solid sense of what she needs to do, where the story needs to progress from there. Because I kind of feel I share the same opinion with some of our listeners that the Andrew Packard, Eckhart, Josie, Catherine, Pete story was just a little bit too convoluted for its own good. It was unnecessarily complicated. So they're trying to tie it all up in one episode and just get all the loose ends and everything sealed into one nice little package. And so this scene helps facilitate that.
So, do you really think he's actually forgiven her, even though he's setting her up?
I mean, I think it's a farewell. I think he has forgiven her in the sense that he's not actively, because, you know, you can be angry at someone in a hot sense or a cold sense. And I think he's probably still angry at her in a cold sense, but not in the hot sense anymore. There's not an issue of jealousy and that kind of emotion. It's more of like, okay, well, your life is in your own hands. You know, Eckhart's the only person who can get you out of here if you choose to let him live. You know, so he's letting her seal her own fate. If she had played her cards right, she could have been on a plane back to Hong Kong before Harry or Cooper could have gotten to her. But she's Josie. She doesn't make any good decisions. So there you go.
So now James and Donna have a picnic. James tells Donna about Evelyn and the cops. Donna says she knows about James and Evelyn, but she is not mad at him. She asks him to come home with her. He says he can't just yet. She then tells him to go ahead and go and to take all the time he needs. He tells her that he loves her and he asks her to come with him, and she says no. He promises to come back to Twin Peaks one day and they kiss.
He also says you're wearing the ring, you know, at the beginning of that scene.
And that's when she tells him she knows about him and Evelyn.
Oh yeah. Now, I liked certain aspects of this scene because I didn't feel like a lot of scenes between the two of them have really been like kind of overdone in the past. But this one had its like hints of subtlety, and I liked it because there was kind of a an end cap to it. She's kind of telling him that she's through with him, I think, in a way, because she's saying, listen, you know, you're going to go away and you're going to have all these stories to tell that aren't going to have anything to do with Laura or Maddie or Evelyn. You know, all these people that you were involved with when you should have just been involved with me because I'm really the right girl for you, but you're going to figure that out later on. But for right now, you just need to go away, you know, and that's why she declines to go with him wherever he's going to go. That, and she probably has to show up to third period biology at some point, unlike him. But she says something. What did she say? It was something to the effect of, I'm tired of being part of things that are bad. I want to be part of something that's good and pure.
Right.
And so, you know, Donna, she's an intelligent girl, you know, and she knows she's worth something. So it's kind of like I think her character, they actually wrote her character good in this scene because she's living up to her own potential and saying, I'm worth a little bit more than you just kind of coming and going whenever you please and going and having your little adventures. I want to be part of something that's real, part of something that's worthy of me as a person. And I know that's reading a lot into it and getting a little sappy about it, but that's what I read out of that scene.
I see what you're saying, but the fact that she was wearing the ring to begin with tells me that she's not done with him at all.
Well, I get, all right, I guess done with him is a wrong way to say it, because I even said myself that like eventually they were, you know, she wants to be with him, but she just, it's kind of like one of those things where it's like, go grow up, go become the man that I want
Yeah,
you to be
I agree with there's
rather
some of
than the
that
boy
there.
that you are.
Yeah. Yeah. So now at the Packards, Catherine and Pete are enjoying their evening where he's messing around with his fly fishing tackle or
So that's what it was. He's like making lures or untangling wire or
I
something.
think he's making fly fishing tackle.
Oh,
I
okay.
don't
All
know for
right.
sure, but that's what I think it is. And she's reading a book, drinking tea. And there's a frantic knock at the door. It's Truman looking for Josie. Pete and Catherine tell how she took the car and has left to the Great Northern to see Thomas Eckhart. Pete realizes at this point that he was an unwilling participant in this setup from Catherine towards Josie. And when Truman leaves, Pete looks at Catherine with some contempt.
He realizes that he was a pawn. Ba-dum-ts.
So now we're at the Great Northern, and Thomas Eckhart is getting to the elevator. Andrew Packard is in the elevator and he reveals himself to him.
Which this reveal just involves taking off a pair of thick rimmed glasses.
Thankfully, only that.
Yeah, only that. There wasn't any Wyndham Earl levels of disguise here.
Or revealing, like, the opening of his fly or anything.
Look who it is. Look who's here.
You
It's
recognize
you.
me?
It's you, Andrew. He's not even looking at his face. He's just like, "It's you, Andrew. I can't believe you're back."
So Andrew starts to talk of Josie because nobody can quit talking about Josie from that household. Eckert says that Josie is his. Eckert also says that he has plans for Truman.
This is a storyline that obviously never gets followed up on, and they never
As far as
intended
we
to.
can remember,
Well,
it could still pay off.
I guess it could still pay off,
It could
but
have set the ball in motion and
yeah, but I mean, he dies in this episode, but you're right, he could have
his
already.
assistant is in the next episode.
That's true. But anyway, I don't remember anything with Truman happening like this, and he's definitely in the last episode of the series because he's there with Doc Hayward helping Cooper out of, after he smashes his face on the glass. So I have forgotten a lot between now and then, but he does survive.
Yes.
But I don't remember if there's any, maybe you do, and you're just not saying it.
No, I'm just saying that just because you don't remember doesn't mean there's not a follow through.
It's not about not me not remembering. That's not, I don't remember. But the reason why I said that was more because, and this could still be wrong, but because he had said it and then he died. So a lot of times when the evil overlord dies, a lot of his plans just kind of fall by the wayside with him.
So Andrew warns Eckhart about Josie, about her treacherous ways, that she's going to come back to him and that he should not trust her. And then they part ways.
That's a it was a nice parting for two guys, who were once great friends, had a huge falling out, pretty much over Josie, I presume, and then one of them tried to kill the other one. Eckhart seemed pretty peeved that he was alive. Like I said, I'm glad this story is wrapping up because it's overly complicated and convoluted.
Meanwhile, Ben, Audrey, and Jack have dinner in the Great Northern Dining Room. He keeps insisting to Audrey to call him Jack.
But she won't do it.
Not yet. Ben has to excuse himself because the chef has tried to stab Jerry. Audrey asks Jack what he is doing here, and she says the horns can take care of themselves, always have, and always will, essentially. But she is smitten with him, especially when he starts talking about the four corners of the earth. She says, "I'm only 18," and he says, "What does that have to do with the price of eggs?"
That really throws her off her game because she's just like, because that's supposed to be like the showstopper, I'm only 18, and then he's supposed to go, "Oh my, ma'am, I have been so, untoward towards you. I'm so sorry," or whatever it is he's supposed to say, whatever empty platitudes you're supposed to offer in way of apology for offending the sensibilities of an 18-year-old.
She has to leave because she has an appointment, so which is at the Roadhouse. But I thought this was a good scene. I thought they both did a really good job. There's a certain allure to them. The camera did close-ups on their faces.
Yeah, there's I know there's a lot of chippers out there who wanted to see Audrey and Cooper be together, but these two actually have a little bit of chemistry on screen, so it's a better fit.
Donna arrives at the Roadhouse and sees Shelley. They both pull out their pieces of paper. Audrey is there as well and contributes her piece. Wyndham Earl watches them from down the bar like a creep.
Yeah, and I already kind of touched upon this. Because it's just like he's in the same disguise he was in when he was at the double R and he left the letter there. And
It would have been funny if Donna was like, "Oh, no, Shelley, don't read it. You dropped out."
She's all condescending. Do you need help with that?
Yeah.
That's a and, and that's a I right there. And she's all looking at her like, bitch. But it's interesting how these three are just kind of like fast friends, even though they've shared very, very little screen time. I mean, for to go back to, I think, Audrey and Donna, when you have Audrey's dance at the very beginning of the series, I mean, you're all the way back there.
Well, we've actually seen them interact, but I don't remember ever seeing Shelley and Audrey ever interact.
No, I don't think I
But of
have
course,
either.
they know each other. It's a small
Yeah,
town.
they all went to high school together
Yeah.
until somebody dropped out to marry Leo Johnson. But don't drop out of high school, kids.
So now Cooper is in his hotel room practicing his fly fishing when he gets a phone call from Catherine telling him where Josie is.
It's really surreal, this scene, because he's sitting there with red socks on, with a red stick and red yarn, just whipping it back and forth, practicing this whole fly fishing thing. And this is the Cooper that we were introduced to in his sharp suits and, no nonsense manner and everything else. And it's come to this, to where he's practicing how to fly fish, and then he's talking to Catherine on the phone, like she can just call him up any old time. Hey, old pal, what are you doing? And it's really neither here nor there in regards to this episode, but it's just kind of like a. I thought about it as this is how far we've taken this story.
Well, the only thought I had about it was it's just cool to have a character who uses downtime productively in pursuit of his hobbies.
Yeah, that's true. He's not just watching TV
Yeah.
like the rest of us.
So, okay, yes, you said it's surreal, and so obviously Catherine and Andrew had created this whole plan to get Eckhart killed by Josie and to get Josie either killed or arrested. So both of those were going to be taken care of.
Two owls with one stone.
So this was the final, part of Catherine's plan was calling Cooper. Cooper goes to investigate and listens outside of Eckhart's door. He hears a gunshot. He busts into the room and discovers Eckhart, and he stands up and we see that he's shot and he soon falls down dead. Josie is pointing her gun at Cooper. Cooper confronts her about the people she's killed and he asks her, why did he shoot him? What did you think of her answer to that?
Weak sauce,
Yes.
bottled, signed, sealed, delivered. Just there's no justification for this. Her only answer is because you showed up,
And that you knew this day was
and
coming.
you knew this day was coming. I mean, Cooper came to Twin Peaks to investigate the murder of Laura Palmer.
Which he was heavily in the midst of at the time that she shot him. Like,
Yeah.
she was not even on his radar.
Because he said shenanigans. I mean, and you're gonna kill a guy? It doesn't make any
Well,
sense.
it's because it wasn't her initially. I don't think they ever intended it to be her until she asked to be written off the show.
So they had to shoehorn it in. But I mean, even given that situation, it seems like a writer with a modicum of creativity could have come up with a more plausible and better idea than that. Even just with 5 minutes alone with two or three other writers, like, okay, let's brainstorm real quick. There's got to be a reason why Josie wanted to cap Cooper. What is it? Put it down. Let's see it. And all they could come up with is because you showed up. I don't know. I don't. This. There's one tiny little thing that I like about this scene, and there's a little bit of misdirection that actually works because when Cooper comes in the room, Josie looks like she's already dead. There's been a gunshot,
Yeah.
and then Eckhart gets up. And before he stands up and you can see the bullet hole in his chest, you don't know that he's shot yet. So you watching it for the first time, you get the impression that it easily could have been her that got shot.
Right. And then when you don't actually see her on her knees with the gun until he falls to the ground, too. And I thought that was a nice move, as far as direction goes. So to finish this scene, Truman arrives. And he tells her to put her gun down. She has a heart attack or her heart fails, something happens. She dies. Bob appears and says, well, only Cooper sees this.
Yeah,
Bob,
she's dying in Truman's
she's
arms,
already dead
or she's dead in
and
Truman's
he's
arms.
cradling her. So he's completely unaware, but Cooper sees Bob appear and Bob is saying, what happened to Josie? And then the man from another place appears and he's dancing on the bed. Josie is now in the drawer pull.
I think that what didn't you have a commentary about her acting?
It's very wooden.
This whole this whole scene just, it doesn't, besides the little bit of misdirection that I mentioned earlier, I think I'm probably speaking for everybody in the whole world who's ever watched Twin Peaks. This doesn't fit. It's really forced in there. The Bob and Mike, the man from another place, however you want to put it, it doesn't belong there.
The Bob thing would have been fine by itself. I mean, I would have dealt with it and tried to like understand it by again, because it's mysterious how she ends up in the drawer pull. So it's got to be something related to that, right?
Sure.
But the man from the other pl another place dancing on the bed, I don't know. It cheapens everything.
Yeah, it's basically just taking a hammer and smashing it over your head as the viewer going, there was a supernatural element to Josie the whole time, and her death as well. And we don't know exactly what we're trying to say, but we're trying to tie an earlier period of Twin Peaks into this period of Twin Peaks, even though it doesn't fit.
That's the thing that really brings this episode down for me. Even though I said at the outset that I mostly like this episode, but every time I think of him dancing on that bed, I almost get angry.
With the exception of Josie, I think this was a one of the more well-acted episodes, especially in season two, as far as the caliber of actors that were on offer and the performances that they put forward.
It was a nice straightforward direction too, after
Yeah, there was no,
last episode.
yeah, there was no Diane Keaton detours into places that we really shouldn't take the show, but this is a bad way to end this episode. And it's disappointing because I feel like you're exactly right. You used the word cheapened, and I couldn't describe it better. That's exactly what it does. It makes it cheap.
So, any other thoughts before we move into feedback?
No, I think I've hit this episode in the knees enough. We can go into feedback.
All right. First up is Daniel. Hey, Em and Steve, this feels like the best episode we've had since Leland died to me. This one feels like the end to another story, which, though handled very poorly in comparison to Laura's, has been there since that first mysterious shot of Josie in the mirror putting her lipstick on in the pilot, a shot which I really loved, how they repeated in this episode as if to tie everything back. How many times can they get away with opening an episode with a shot of chess pieces?
Don't ask, they'll think it's a competition.
Hank does have a point. The jurisdiction that Sheriff Truman represents would be interested in pursuing new information about Andrew Packard's death, and we know Hank has, being that Josie paid him $90,000 to do the job, and it is a major conflict of interest that the main conspirator behind the attempt on his life is the woman Truman has been sleeping with all this time.
Well, Truman's never going to have to face the music on that one because, you know, after everything that happens in this episode, it becomes a moot point because that person that they're referring to that he's been sleeping with is now dead, and Hank's going to be in jail anyway. So,
And Andrew Packard's alive.
yeah, so there you go. I mean, it's all of it is just, it gets kind of obliterated. But it's still a good, he does have a good point, though.
Yes.
Bef At that point in the story, we don't know that all these things are
But
going to
Truman's
happen.
not thinking rationally here, so he's not going to think along those lines.
He's
And
definitely not thinking about re-election to the office of sheriff at this point.
no.
You know, he's thinking about Jesus Christ, the woman I love is a murderer. Mean, I know how he feels, but.
So Daniel continues to say, when I first watched this episode, I felt relieved that it was finally sending off three characters who had become nothing but dead weight on the show, James, Hank, and Josie. Unfortunately, it introduces two more bland characters, John Justice Wheeler and Norma's sister on the phone, Annie. But I'll save my take on those two for later episodes where they feature more prominently. I will say, though, that Jack doesn't look like he's pounded a nail in his life. I have to agree with that.
Oh yeah, we didn't touch on that, but you're absolutely right. That guy, he doesn't look like he's done an honest day's labor in his whole life. You know, he'd be like one of those characters in a movie where, remember Jaws, when the guy's all like, "Let me see your hands, let me see your hands," and he's like, "These hands are soft. They haven't done a work, you know, they haven't done a day's work in their life." And it somebody should do that to him because it just seems like, you know, he seems to fit the bill of the guy who wants to kind of frame himself as like, well, I came up the hard way, and you know, I like tooth and nail, and I worked myself to the bone, and so it's like, no, you didn't.
Well, he's supposed to have this modesty also. Like, he's supposed to be embarrassed at the praise that Ben gives him.
Yeah.
And his modesty comes off false to me. And I was like, that's why he was cast in Titanic
Yeah.
as the character, because he does play
Yeah.
that other end of the spectrum much better.
Shit, what's it's just like Ron Swanson says on Parks and Recreation, false modesty is a form of lying. And he's right. He's right. If you've got what you've got, to be falsely modest about it is, in a way, lying. I mean, that guy's a big, dispenser of wisdom anyway, and this is just another nugget that he's dished out to everybody. But so he, I guess what I'm trying to say in a serious sense, in the context of the show, is like to your point that it's a form. He's being dishonest, and he's being like ickily dishonest. It's creepy because he's just like, oh, well, I'm so modest, and I don't want to hear that good stuff about me, which I know is true. And then he smiles, and his tooth gleams in the
Well,
light.
I don't
Ding.
know if it's like the character is being dishonest or if Billy Zane is just not as good of an actor as you're claiming he was earlier in the podcast.
I don't know. I think he's actually, that's the role he's playing. He's playing the role of somebody who is
Falsely modest.
falsely modest, but he's also pompous at the same time, and that has to come with false modesty, I think, a certain amount of it. You may not want to hear praise about yourself, but on some level you know it's true, and it makes you uncomfortable because you don't view yourself as a person that's possibly worthy of that or something. But people who actively are falsely modest are, to me, I've always pictured them as fishing for that praise, but not wanting to get it in a completely blunt fashion. They want it to be something else that doesn't seem like they're getting patted on the back, but they are. Convoluted, I know, but that's how I see it.
All right, so moving on to the next part. Daniel says, I think they do a good job emphasizing the claustrophobia that Josie is feeling as all her lies are being exposed and people are coming for her on all sides. Josie may be the most disappointing character in the series for me because of how much potential I thought she originally had, though alongside James and Hank, it's hard to choose sometimes. She fits the archetype of the woman in trouble that Lynch loves to explore in his work so much. In the first season, she was a mystery, and I wanted to know what this beautiful, well, to people in the show anyways, exotic, wealthy, sophisticated woman was doing in this remote backwoods town. I feel like if Isabella Rossellini had played that role as Giovanna, as was originally scripted, maybe Lynch would have stayed more involved and her character arc would, could have been more significant and interesting. Certainly, she was initially going to be a potential love interest for Agent Cooper, but maybe they could have emphasized Josie as an example of what Laura could have grown up to become had she lived and submitted herself fully to Bob's fire and let it use her to be, bring others to her own ruin. But this last-minute effort to tie her into the mythology feels like too little, too late.
Exactly. We gave our own version of that a little while ago on the podcast, but I think I'm right. I haven't read any of the listener feedback. I'm hearing it for the first time now, but I'm guessing Joel is going to be of the same opinion as well, that this just does not fit. It is too little, too late. Amen.
I wonder what it would have been with Isabella Rossellini. I know she had a conflict, and that's why she couldn't do it, but.
Well, it brings up two interesting points by saying all this, because the first one, if it was Isabella Rossellini, how awesome would that have been? I don't think I would have hated that character because, and I don't hate Josie because Joan Chen is a bad actress. I hate Josie because, mostly because she says, oh, Harry, a lot. But just the fact that I feel like she was an abandoned character. She's like a, it's almost like, Daniel mentions how David Lynch has this affinity for the troubled female and putting her in these situations where something needs to happen, and that's where we get a lot of the drama in his stories. But then he abandons her and leaves her, literally.
Yeah.
He leaves the show. So where does she go? How does she get written? Well, Cooper's easy to handle. Truman's easy to handle. Hell, Albert's easy to handle, or whoever else. But Josie, it's a very specific Lynchian thing. And then once he's not there to keep that thread going, it's a hellaciously difficult job to do. And I think it failed.
Yeah, they had her run off a lot so they didn't have to deal with her character.
Yeah, she was gone for good chunks of time.
Like more than once.
Shopping in Seattle.
So Daniel says, this was the scene where Peggy Lipton, who plays Norma, was quite upset because no one on set gave her any warning that Chris Mulkey, who plays Hank, was actually going to grab her roughly and pull her face into the bars.
Ooh.
Hopefully, 25 years later, Hank will have finished serving his sentence and have another chance at doing something interesting.
Hopefully not working at the diner.
So I guess there was another incident where he did something like this, because what I had read about was in the first scene they did together.
I mean, honestly, I don't blame Peggy Lipton. I would have been pissed off about that shit too.
Especially if this was a repeat occurrence, like if he kept doing it despite her protestations, you know, like, dude, I don't fucking like it when you do this. Stop.
And then, but you really can't. I mean, as long as the director wasn't in on it behind her back, that would be shitty. But I can understand if that didn't happen. Okay, but like, if the shot comes out good because she gets an honest reaction on her face, and then they use it, I can kind of see that. But you know, you kind of do the whole William Friedkin thing, and just you know, you make other people's misfortune the highlight of your film. But that's shitty though.
Daniel says, I'm so glad to hear Donna finally admit that she's been a part of all the horrible things that have happened. Truer words have never been spoken. Yeah, you're talking about like her involvement with Harold.
Definitely. She's
Yeah.
guilty as charged on that. I mean, they all
And
kind of
then
got away
her treatment
scot-free.
with towards Maddie even. So.
Yeah, she's gotten away with a lot of stuff. You know, she hasn't really had to deal with things the way everybody else has had to deal with them.
Daniel says, I want to see the scene where the chef is trying to stab Jerry.
I can picture it though, because Jerry's such a what we would refer to nowadays as a foodie, and that term was probably around back then, but it wasn't so prevalent. And he's back there going, no, you gotta poach the basil just like this in the butter, and then you add it. He's like, get out of my kitchen or I will stab.
Horn Industries is probably failing now because Audrey blew the entire budget on sparing no expense for the elaborate sets of the Appomattox scenario. Yeah, you're probably right. I mean, they had to pay for that stuff. None of...
They didn't just have that shit lying around, did
No,
they? I mean,
that kind of stuff's expensive.
'cause I imagine I always pictured it as Ben got like more and more into this whole Civil War mind frame. He might have had like the general's uniform around 'cause he's like a history buff or something. I could buy that. But then he had to get all these other accoutrements to go with it, and he's like sending these people out. And I mean, Bobby had to go and fight down some bikers, you know, to come back with his uniform, so.
It is bizarre how all three girls follow the instructions of a creepy handwritten note and just go where it tells them, no questions asked. I know, if you learned nothing, did this show not start with a murdered high school girl?
Yeah, I mean,
But they found out it was her father, so he's gone. Things are safe now, right?
yeah, Leland Palmer's gone. The big bad wolf is dead. So everybody can now heed the requests of a creepy note that gets sent to them on torn paper. No.
Not three of the girls are in these weird limbo places with their relationship status.
Yeah.
Like Donna has just told James to go off and do whatever you want. I'll be here. Shelley and Bobby are kind of weird, you know, with.
Well, Shelley and Bobby are weird, and her husband, who is apparently no longer an invalid, is running around somewhere in the woods outside of Twin Peaks.
And then Audrey is kind of in between love,
Well,
loves.
she's still, I think she still has residual feelings for Cooper, but she's met somebody who's probably a better match for her. So you're right, that puts her exactly in that category to where she's in a transition phase, like, what do I do now?
Yeah,
So maybe
transition
they're,
phase is a good word
so you, are
for
you,
all of them.
are you kind of pointing to the fact that they could all be doing this out of hopefulness that this could be some sort of romantic intrigue?
Maybe. I mean, they're needing something to shake them up from all the conflicted emotions they're experiencing right now. But it doesn't excuse it.
I mean, it gives a somewhat plausible explanation for a fucking shit poor decision on all three of their parts. But hey, they're all 18 or over now, so they can do what they want.
Josie's reason for shooting Cooper still seems so lame and contrived to me. Because you came here, eye roll.
Exactly. Yeah. We thrashed this around a bit earlier, but that I agree 100%. I still, you know, all right, I'm going to reiterate just for 2 seconds and just say a room full of writers should have been able to come up with something better than that. Sorry, guys.
For several episodes now, they have been building up the name of Thomas Eckert as some monstrous kingpin of global business and organized crime, but yet he seems like just another sap in love with Josie, who ends up being completely forgettable. It is also hard to see him as menacing when he is played by Tiny Tim's dad from George C. Scott's A Christmas Carol.
You know, actors always carry baggage with them when they go to their next role. And I mean, it takes a superior actor to make you forget that. especially if you've seen them in something iconic, you know? I mean, could you imagine Chevy Chase doing like a serious drama role and just not thinking about Fletch? Or,
I
you
don't
know,
know.
actors bring baggage from their other roles, and sometimes it's harder to get over that, especially if they don't really knock it out of the park.
Daniel says, I cannot laugh whenever Michael Ancine raises his voice and acts angry. The way he snarls, put it down, makes me think of Yosemite Sam from the Looney Tunes for some reason.
Rascally varmint.
I laughed when he was like, get him out of here. It's like his mouth moves completely to the side of his face.
Yeah, he becomes a caricature of himself for a
He's trying
second.
to throw his voice.
Get him out of here! And you know the part where he's just punching his hand really hard,
Oh,
and he's just
yeah.
he's it's like he's just gonna say, "Dagnabbit, gosh darn it!" You know, no cuss word is ever gonna come out of his mouth. But this is also the early '90s, so I mean, Albert got away with a bitch in this episode, and that's still a rarity at this time.
Well, this was funny to me, and I wasn't going to share it because it's one of those things. But things kind of started to look like this to me. But I was wondering if like half of his coffee cup was full of Jameson's, and if you really like pay attention to even just some of his more basic movements, I think he might be drunk.
Huh. It's entirely believable given the situation that
always.
he's in. Yeah. Oh, you mean always? Okay. Like at the beginning of the episode, whenever he's talking to Coop and he's like, I'm not gonna let you out of my sight from now on. And he's like, look, Harry, if Earl wanted me dead, I'd be dead. Harry looks at him and just kind of goes, yeah.
Well, he's very slow to
But
react to a lot of things.
it's so nonchalant. He's just
Yeah.
like, yeah. Just takes another sip.
See?
You're on to something here. Drunk Truman. How would his constituents feel about that?
Daniel says, some fans don't, but I like the ending. I find it creepy how we hear that familiar ominous twinkling sound and Truman and Josie fade to dead space as a spotlight comes on and Bob's hideous laughter echoes in Cooper's ears while his denim-clad arm reaches up from underneath the bed. Bob is finally back, and by showing us the little man again, who we haven't seen since episode two, the writers solidify that there's a connection between Bob and the Red Room. And it hints that all these people and their checkered storylines, not just the Palmers, are potential prey for those dark forces.
That's a different take on it than what I had. I mean,
I'm glad you can be positive about it, Daniel.
yeah, because
Honestly.
visually, I liked it because that's some of my favorite parts of Twin Peaks and the little man and Bob and stuff like that and the whole red or lodge lore, we'll call it. I really like all that stuff. So on a visual level, I was tickled to see it, but I just can't bring myself to feel like it was an integral part of Josie's story. I've never really felt that Josie was as close to that as they wanted to make it seem at the end. So I'm not feeling it, I guess, on a story level.
Yeah, I've already stated my feelings about it. Seeing the little man mussing up the sheets. Doesn't do it for me visually. So Daniel says, so what do you think the connection between Josie's death and Bob and the little man appearance might actually be? In an early episode of the podcast, I think it was Em who mentioned she thought there was a piece of Bob inside Josie or something. Well, I hadn't seen this episode in a long time, Daniel, and I knew there was a connection between Bob and Josie based on this episode, and but I couldn't remember the specifics, so I can't really answer that question. I think I had a vague understanding, and that's probably why I said a piece.
I can say for my part, I mean, I know I didn't really make any, or I don't remember making any specific comments in that direction,
You did.
but I did. Okay, but I could
Fish in the
see,
percolator.
oh, the fish in the percolator. Yeah, I could see Bob being a part of Josie insofar as Bob is a part of everything that's nasty and unwanted and evil and dark that happens in and around Twin
Yeah.
Peaks. He's representative of a lot of sins, I guess, for, you know, a complete lack of a better term or way to explain that. So he's there in a way, but not nearly in the same way that he was with Leland or Laura, obviously.
And that's why we heard the same vocal manipulation that they use with Bob and Mike, when Evelyn shot Malcolm
Yeah, exactly.
last
There
episode.
you go, because it's just an extrapolation of that. There's a negativity, there's an evil, there's a darkness. So we have a shade of that there. I wish we could offer up something more because it's a good question, but I think that she wanted to be written off the show, so they had to do something with her character, and I think they wanted to have her go out in more of a stylistic fashion than just getting shot by Harry, which probably would have been a better option, in my opinion, because it would have added to the, you know, the drama of it, because now he's going to be grieving for the next couple episodes anyway, as we already know, but he would have had the added emphasis of knowing that he shot the woman he loved, which is a shitty situation for a real person to be in, but a great situation for a, you know, somebody in a TV show to be in.
I agree with you. I think that would have been better.
Yeah. And the fact that they bring back the lore, but they do it in a half-assed way, which is to say, hey, it almost felt like they were saying, hey, we're still here. This is still part of Twin Peaks. And Josie was a small part of this. We're not really going to explain to you how that fits into everything else, but here it is. And that's why I didn't like it.
Well, and they bring up this in result with what they chose to do. We've got this whole new other thing with her being inside the drawer pole. I mean, is there going to be follow through with that? You know, if it comes out in 2016 or 2017, I mean, whatever the fuck.
Yeah.
I don't think it's going to happen anymore. But anyway, I mean, what's the deal? I know, you know, Into the Woods, there's supposed to be a lot of, and then you got the log, Lady's Log, and so spirits can inhabit wood. I guess that's what that is.
So now Josie's inhabiting a
drawer pull.
A drawer pull in a drawer in the Great Northern. Forever and ever, amen, till it burns down. I don't know. It's a lot of speculation, but I feel like at the end of the day, I hate to be the naysayer, but I feel like this was shoehorned in there. So there's not really anything to find because they just tried to tie in an earlier part of Twin Peaks with it, which is a kind of a resurfacing motif of season two, unfortunately.
All right, let's move on.
Okay.
Oh, okay. Daniel says, David Lynch was the one who decided that Josie goes into the doorknob. It certainly ties into the overall mythology surrounding the woods, such as the log lady's mediumship through the log and its hinted connections to her dead husband, as I was just saying. according to Frank Silva, at the 1993 Twin Peaks Fest, in the final episode that Lynch directed, he filmed shots of Josie's torso and legs sticking out through the curtains of the Red Room as if she was trapped between two worlds. It's too bad that didn't make it to the final cut because it would have been a nice touch. Also, interestingly, Robert Engels has mentioned in interviews before that in one version of Fire Walk With Me, the Judy from Seattle that David Bowie mentions could have been Josie's sister, and that something involving those two and Windham Earl had gone down in Buenos Aires. What happened to Josie? Daniel wants to know. Well, that's interesting. Oh. Huh.
See, it's intriguing to me that we get all of this side information that you would never, ever know just from watching the show. That you have to, you know, you have to hear about from, well, now that we have the interweb, everything's available. That's the great thing about the information age. So we can kind of put all these pieces together in a big mosaic and get a bigger picture of what's going on. But it still doesn't tell you, you know, what could have been or what might have been doesn't really give too much insight into what actually is sometimes. If that makes any sense. I know it's a mouthful. But what I'm saying is you could take all these pieces of like, this writer wanted to do this thing with this actor and that actor and this storyline, but none of this ever came to fruition. But so we're still left with just Josie, you know, going into the wood pole and that's it. We don't get that scene of her being half in and half out of the lodge. We don't get any extrapolation about her sister and Windham Earl and Buenos Aires. You know, we don't get that. So it's hard to pull that in. It's nice to speculate on. It'd be interesting. I wish it was canonized by the people who kind of are the gatekeepers of the Twin Peaks mythology. Like whenever they do the Blu-ray box set, like they did, like if they could have had, they could also sell a companion book that has, you know, these are the stories that were going to be done but never got done. Here they are all in collected in one place.
Cool.
Instead of searching the dark reaches of the internet, you know, and hoping what you read is actually authentic, you know, because there is still bullshit out there. And I'm not saying any of this is bullshit. Don't get me wrong. But I mean, it's hard to know what's true and what's not until it comes from some sort of official source.
Thank you, Daniel, for that.
Yeah, that was, I mean, it brought up some good points. I'm sorry I don't have more to add about, you know, like, and I'm sorry, I'm so negative about the whole Josie ending with the, you know, the people from the lodge and stuff, but I that's just my take on it. I feel like it was forced in there. And I'm glad that you have a, you know, 'cause I often take that position. I often take the position of being a little bit lighter about stuff
Yeah,
and,
you
you know,
do.
and a little bit less harsh and judgy about what's going on. And this time I'm kind of like
But Daniel's the positive one.
yeah. So it's nice to kind of switch positions with somebody on that.
All right, so next up is Joel. He says, Stephen M., thanks for the compliments. Your check is in the mail. And now for the dreaded drawer pull. This episode falls into a very weird place in Twin Peaks lore. On the one hand, many fans see it as the beginning of the recovery. After all, we are putting a final stamp on the last of the dreadful mid-season storylines. Josie's endless and boring shenanigans. New subplots are beginning. Not the Pine Weasel or John Justice Wheeler are especially enticing.
Nobody's a fan of that.
Wyndham Earl is finally beginning to interact with townspeople instead of just Cooper, as he invites Audrey, Shelley, and Donna to the Roadhouse. Also, this means we finally get to see characters breaking out of their private bubbles and crossing paths as they did in the first season, something we will see more of as the Miss Twin Peaks pageant approaches. Leslie Linka Glatter, who directed arguably the best non-Lynch episode of the series so far, returns to the director's chair. The final image has been traced to David Lynch himself, as I'm sure Daniel, Tyler, and M have probably already noted. I think the Reflections book was a big confirmation of this fact. We even get to see Bob and the Little Man again. On the other hand, we get to see Bob and the Little Man again in completely anticlimactic fashion. I know others disagree, but I just don't find anything scary about Bob as he's used here. The camera is too far away, his dialogue is too goofy, and the whole situation just feels forced, using the same word you're using. Didn't you say forced?
I think I did.
And the little man dancing on the bed plays like a parody of Twin Peaks to me, almost like the Simpsons spoof of the show, in which Homer is watching a giant dance with a white horse under a swinging spotlight, and he laughs and says, "Brilliant," then admits, "I have absolutely no idea what is going on." The first time I watched the scenes, it seems like even as the show was messing everything up, it had left Lynch's imagery alone. Now it was solely in that, too. It seemed like the show had just jumped the shark at this point. And while it is a relief to see the Josie story finally end, but we still have to endure it for a little bulk of this episode. I think it took me 4 or 5 rewatches to actually figure out what the hell Andrew Packard's plan entails, and even then it was like, oh, that's it? So I find that this episode drags, but it does feel like we are now seeing the light at the end of the tunnel. I like the next one much more, despite the ridiculous fashion show. I have attached a Simpsons clip for your enjoyment if you haven't seen or forgotten it. Okay. Seeing you next week for the Pine Weasel Riot, Joel.
We did watch the Simpsons clip before we actually did this episode of the podcast, and it's pretty funny. I don't remember seeing that one. I watched a lot of Simpsons in the early 90s. I might have actually seen it and just not remembered it. I mean, that's so long ago.
You probably didn't know
Or
how
yeah,
to,
I
you didn't
did.
make the connection.
Yeah, there's nothing to make it stick because I didn't know what the hell Twin Peaks was back in 1990. But so I Joel's Joel and I are on the same page with this one. It feels forced and everything, and it's kind of cool because usually Joel and Daniel are on the same page, and they're kind of conflicting a little bit about how they saw this episode. And this is, to me, this is really where it gets interesting and fun with the feedback and stuff like that, because you get these opposing views, and I can just pick a side. And that I feel like I'm honestly in the middle, because I didn't hate this episode, and it's interesting that some people do view it as the beginning of the comeback, because I would probably say that that would have to start with the next episode. Not that I remember it so much, but I don't feel this doesn't have a comeback feel to me. It has a kind of a closure feel of some less than stellar storylines, and then so it seems plausible that we can kind of get the ball rolling towards a better end in the next episode. But
Well, coming off the heels of the previous episode, it definitely feels
it's it,
I can understand what everybody's saying.
yeah. Well, it seemed like the bar just kind of kept getting lower and lower for what was considered a good episode inside of season two. So, you know, when somebody says something is perfectly serviceable, that applies to this episode. It's not great, but it's not bad. And but it is head and shoulders above the
Last three.
artifice over style, or I'm sorry, artifice over substance episode that was the last one. And I feel I'm over explaining my point of view on this because I feel like whenever I'm the naysayer about something, I have to make it known why I'm the naysayer because I'm not just trying to be like a harsh jerk. You know what I mean? Because I'm usually the one who's kind of taking the lighter tone of view and saying, well, there's this positive element or there's that positive element, but I'm not doing that in this episode, so it's weird.
Well, I did it last episode.
Yeah. All right. I can just suck it up.
Yes, yeah, suck it up.
Yeah. Little man dancing on the bed is silly, goddammit.
It is.
I'm not gonna go back from that.
And
Even
I agree
though
with Joel. I think Bob's not scary, and what he says is goofy. I agree.
I still stick with what I said that I like the visual element of it. Bob wasn't scary, but it was cool to see him again. It's kind of like
Yeah,
seeing an old friend or something. He is as
I.
strange as that sounds.
Yeah.
More so with the little man than him. But I just wish that it was more contextualized is all. I feel like it was lacking the needed contextualization to really make it integrated into the larger picture of Twin Peaks. But anyway, that's all I've got to say about this episode. Thanks for writing, you guys.
All right, well, that's it for now. I am your host, Em.
And I'm your host, Steve.
We mean it like it is.
Like it sounds.
This was a No Ship Network podcast brought to you by Axolotl Tank Productions.